Welcome to Marketing Tips for Translators, a podcast with marketing and business tips and strategy specifically for freelance translators and interpreters. I'm your host, Tess Whitty, a longtime freelance translator with an education and professional background in marketing. Tune in to hear tips from my own experience or from other translators and industry experts. This episode is sponsored by my free masterclass, Online Marketing for Translators and Interpreters, where you can learn how to transform your website and online presence on social media into client-generating machines. It looks like networking with clients at conferences and events will still not be possible for quite a while. This means that we all need to rely on connecting with clients online. There is no better time than now to review your online presence and make sure you are attracting your ideal clients. That's why I want to offer this free training in online marketing for translators and interpreters. During this training, you will learn how to optimize your website and social media online to attract clients to you. You will identify who you want to attract to your online platforms. You will learn strategies and tips for your website design and optimization, so search engine optimization. Learn how to leverage social media to attract your ideal clients. And you will get tips and tools to analyze your online marketing and see if it's really working. You can get instant access to this training at marketingtipsfortranslators.com/online-marketing. I can't wait to help you market your services online. So go to marketingtipsfortranslators.com/online-marketing. See you there. Hi there. Welcome to the Marketing Tips for Translators podcast. I hope you're doing well. Today and during some upcoming episodes this summer, I will do reruns of some older podcast episodes that you might have missed. The content will most likely be very relevant for you right now. We will talk about added client value on websites, how to use website to market your services, how to become more productive, how to best apply to translation agencies, and much more. As always, I would love to hear any feedback or questions you might have. So let's get started. Welcome to the Marketing Tips for Translators. In this episode, we're going to talk more about what agencies really want from us, translators. With me today, I have the presenter who is a boutique agency owner from the UK. Not only that, he's also a kung fu pro. I'm saying this in Swedish. How do you? Kung fu.
Yeah, very good.
And he's a movie star, been featured in one of the most popular Chinese movies of all time. Mm-hmm. He's also an agency, like I said, boutique agency owner, Constructive Translations. Welcome so much to the podcast, David Smith.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very good. So a movie star, huh?
Yeah, very. It's something I don't tell everyone about.
How did that happen?
Just pure luck. Because in China, there's a big lack of Caucasian people who speak Chinese. Those of us, especially back in the late 90s, so the few of us who were living there who spoke Chinese would often get contacted to do things like appearing on media shows, advertisements, and all kinds of stuff. Got asked to play an extra in a movie. And they came with me, so they gave me a bigger role and then a bigger role. And then they got kind of government funding for the movie and released it. It's a big government thing. And it went on to be very, very popular in China. What year? 2001 or two, maybe. The film, what happened was the Chinese government got behind the film because they liked the political message of it. And once the Chinese government gets behind something, you know, bomb, it explodes. So So I don't think, honestly, I don't think a huge number of people saw it, but every cinema had to screen it, you know? And it was kind of one of those things that every shop was told they had to sell it, and every newspaper had to do an article about it. So at the time, we were told it was the most popular docudrama ever made at that time. Whether it is now, I don't know.
All right.
Quite fun, though, I must admit.
Cool.
Yeah, a lot of cold days filming in the minus 20, wearing a thin cotton T-shirt for half of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So did you learn Kung Fu in China or in England?
Well, that's actually the reason I went to China. I did Kung Fu since I was very young, since I was about six. And then when I hit 21 years old, I decided I wanted to train a bit more. That's when I went out to China purely to study Kung Fu. And my original plan was that it would be 6 weeks, and 6 weeks became 8 weeks, and that became 3 months, and then it became 6 months, and then a year, and then it almost hit 10 years. And I finally thought, what happened? What happened to my life? You know,
I recognize that situation.
Life gets away from you sometimes, doesn't it? But it was good. I'm glad I did it anyway.
Yes. Let's go back. So you've lived in China, you're British and you lived in China, but tell us a little bit more about your career in translation.
So in translation, but basically while I was in China, even when I was still very low level in Chinese, I was getting given a lot of Chinese to English work because there's a huge lack of native English speakers in China. Huge lack. I think someone said to me, if every single American citizen was a qualified translator and they all translated Chinese to English, there would still be a lack of Chinese to English translators. You know, it's just such a, you know, there's how many billion people, you know, and everyone.
I have to tell that to my son. He's studying Chinese.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the way to go at the moment, to be honest. I mean, when I was originally 97, at that time, everyone knew China was the big developing nation and everything. But a lot of people were talking about maybe Brazil would be the place to go, maybe India. And now I think possibly it'll be all three of them, you know. But at the time, it didn't seem certain that China would be the next power. But I think the last few years now, everyone agrees, you know, learn Chinese or don't bother doing business for the next few decades. And it's good. It's exciting, you know.
So you started translating in China.
Yeah, so started translating. It was a very gradual thing. It was what we would call, I mean, thinking back, the quality must have been absolutely painful, you know. It's just they needed a native speaker to review it, you know. Very, very low rates, awful jobs, terrible deadlines. I did more and more of that, gradually moved away from teaching, which is my other source of income. Translated more and more. And then when I hit 30, I had a kind of midlife crisis. I thought, what am I going to do? What job do I do? And I decided to do a master's degree in translation and get a proper job, you know. And so I did the master's degree in London at Imperial College. Then I went back to Taiwan for 2 years because I got a really good scholarship out there. I worked as a translator there and then came back to London, and I've been working now as a very, very serious translator, my only source of income, I've been doing it must be 6 or 7 years now. Including the time when it was almost like a hobby and I was just doing bits here and there, probably something towards 15, 16 years of translating.
Okay. So you started as a freelance translator who have now turned into a boutique agency.
Yeah. And that transition, I would say, if I'm completely honest, I'm still in the middle. No, I'm not in the middle. I'm still making that very difficult transition. And the reason is that, unfortunately, it takes time to build up in sales. They call it a pipeline, you know, of clients. And when you don't have the clients to pay the bills, you still have to pay the bills. So it's a matter of trying. For me, I'm trying to kind of organically move from freelancing to just doing pure agency work. And what I tend to do is freelance in the evenings or weekends, or if I've got a quiet week managing the company, I might take on a couple of freelance jobs or for agencies that I really get on with. And I'm trying not to accept any new agencies. I'm sort of gradually thin them out. and put more mm-hmm. time into the company. So at the moment, mm-hmm. I'm working far more hours than I ever have and making mm-hmm. far less money, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. not a good combination. But that's, I knew that would happen. That's always the way it is with these companies. They take, you know, we sat down and we said, we think it would be about 2 solid years of aggressive sales and marketing before we can start paying ourselves reasonable salaries. And that is pretty much on schedule or slightly ahead of schedule.
Okay.
So, you know, it's what I expected. I'm quite happy to do it.
Well, you gave a really good presentation at the conference in Zagreb, and I think that your situation is very beneficial, at least to other translators, because you seem like a very good company to work for as a freelancer, and that must be because you have a freelancing background.
It is. In fact, I constantly get told off by my marketing director because
okay.
I can't help. I always see things from the translator's side. And the marketing guy says, you know, that's the operations. You don't let them do it. And, you know, I will not try and squeeze the translator to get them to do it cheaper. And the marketing guy says, well, we can't put the price up anymore and we don't have enough this, we don't have enough that. So the translators have to be cheaper. But I always say the whole point of our company is that in 5 years, the same translators will be working with us because they like us and we like them. We're not. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just grow quickly by using people who will reject, you know, resent working for us or with us. And then as soon as they get better clients, they'll leave. We will grow more sustainably if we find partners who are, you know, like, I think back to what I was like maybe 5 or 6 years ago. The kind of agency I wanted then would be a partner who could really understand where I'm going and try and help me get there rather than just squeezing you to make as much money as they can in the short term. And I do think there's definitely a market out there, because I think if you start to get too much negative feedback from translators, it does impact on your business.
Yes, I think this strategy will pay off in the end, both towards the client and the translators.
Well, that's our bet. You know, we're betting that that will happen. So, you know, the other thing is you've got to enjoy your life, right? And I wouldn't be happy if I thought I was exploiting people. We're having to squeeze people. I think you can make my sort of value, the proposition I made is that we can pay fair prices to good translators, charge our clients fair rates, and still make a bit of a living. As long as we do it slowly and we do have to get the strategy right and the marketing position right. And I do believe that's the case.
So does your agency only work with Chinese English, or do you work with all languages?
We sat down right at the beginning and we looked at what were going to be our costs and what was going to be our potential benefit. And we worked out that even though Chinese would be a huge, easy thing for us to do, as I understand it, and I know so many people who understand it, we just wouldn't be able to make enough money to pay the bills doing Chinese. Because there's too much downward competition from Chinese companies. And there's a, you know, a Chinese business couldn't afford to pay us to do something. It would have to be a UK business. And there's not actually that many that have requirements that have to be done by people in the UK. So we basically work, according to our calculations, we won't be able to make a living just doing Chinese. So we decided to do, we say all business languages. We've got a few that we've got agencies where we'd contract the whole lot to them, like some of the African languages, other ones, Arabic, Indian languages. We just give the whole job to an agency, make sure the client knows what we've done. But all the EU languages, I mean, to be honest, they're easy enough. We just go to the ITI database. We've got a lot of good people on there that have already been tested and examined. So, we can offer whichever language the clients need.
Okay. So let's say that I want to apply to your agency. What's the best way?
The best way, honestly, is not to apply. And I know that sounds crazy. Like, now that I've spoken to you on this podcast, in the back of my head now, I imagine you must do pretty good work or you wouldn't be doing this podcast. And the people that I've seen year in, year out at the conferences, you know, you go to conferences like me, right, and you see the same faces again and again. Without ever seeing their CV, I would bet that they do really, really good work. Those people, if I've got a job, I would rather reach out to them than someone who's just posted a CV to me.
Okay.
So, like, if you say best, I think the best way is to get to know the company owners or the company, or, you know, the relevant people, and kind of organically network out. If you do have to send a CV, which of course you do, I think the best thing you can do is make it clear and concise so that the person reading it knows what you do, how you do it, and what you can actually do to what, when, if you say, I'm a technical expert, give us a one line proof, you know, I'm a technical expert because I have a degree in, you know, aviation or something, then that, that makes it much easier for us to say, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. We don't want these really great big long CVs where there seems to be a lot of, you know, scattergun marketing and people talking to us as though we're a direct client when we're not, we're an agency. I think if you're applying to an agency, just be clear and concise, and be aware we know what translators can do, and we know terms like native speaker, and we know things like source and target. You don't have to explain it to us like you were a direct client. Have like a tailored CV. And also, if you send us a CV, it has to go to the right email address. It's not hard to find that email address on our website. Still get a lot of them going to, you know, all kinds of different email addresses. And ideally, put a person's name on it, put my name on it, or anyone else's name. You know, just take a minute to look at our company, you know, and then make sure that you've written to us, not as if it's a letter that you've sent to a million people identically.
So I get this a lot. I even get these applications, and I don't understand why freelancers keep sending them. Because I don't think they work. These generic mass emails sent to whom it may concern, or dear sir. Yeah.
I'd be amazed if any of them ever get a job. I mean, I suppose they must get one or two, or they wouldn't bother. But I mean, certainly it's not a sustainable career if you have to do that to get one agency, you know.
So the best way to apply to your agency is actually to be in the database, for example, ITI, be out there, go to conferences, and if you apply, be very personal and specific.
Yeah, make it clear that you've actually – don't just send me a letter that looks like you could have written it to any agency. You know? I know it is hard. Agencies are – they do basically the same fundamental thing, which is translate. So you don't have to kind of change the entire structure of the letter. But, you know, we have a niche, which is construction and engineering. So at least mention that in the email, you know. You don't have to go on and on about it, but at least mention that you know we've got a niche. And if you're not in that niche, that's fine. You know, if you say, I'm a legal expert, I know you focus on engineering, but if you ever get a legal job, you know, let me know. And that's absolutely fine. I mean, we love to get that kind of application. But, you know, at least try and make the suggestion that you've actually taken the time to see if we're suitable for you.
Yes.
Scattergun CVs are just, to be honest, I think the marketing people get really annoyed with them as well. So if they're in a rush, it's likely to just be deleted.
So how do I make sure that agencies keep wanting to work with me?
That's a really good question. The first thing I think is we can talk about it on two levels. The first level is do the job you said you'll do, and do it as you said you'll do it, and you'll always, when there's more work that's suitable, it'll be there for you. But I've kind of come to see things a bit differently. I think if you're looking, like a company like mine, I need all kinds of help in all kinds of things, from marketing to sales to recruitment. Every aspect of this company, we would appreciate any help we can get.
Okay.
And people who have, like there's a freelancer in Singapore who always takes the time to see how the company's going, and she reads our blog and everything else. And she can write me letters based on things on the blog and say, oh, I see you went to this trade show. Do you know there's another one coming up in this country next month? Would you know, you know, maybe I can go if you'd like on your behalf. Would you like, you know, and that kind of thing to a company like mine is so valuable that she will always be my first choice. If I bring in a marketing director, or if I bring in an operations guy, and he says, oh, I'd rather use someone else because they're cheaper, I would say, no, she was there when we needed her. We know she cares about, she's on our side. You know, they're on our side. They want our business to succeed as much as we do. If you're in that, that's to me is like the premiership of freelancers. It's kind of more than just doing your job description, you know?
They go above and beyond.
Yeah. Although if you do just your job description, which is translate it, that should be enough, assuming there's regular work for you in that language combination, you know?
Okay.
But if you go above it, there's even if we don't have stuff in your language, we may find you things to do. You know, and it's, by the way, I think that's, I worked in a bank for a couple of years, and I noticed that the people that were getting made redundant, we had a lot of redundancies in my bank, Bank of America. And the people that were getting made redundant, they were doing their jobs. They were doing what was on their job description. The people who were staying were kind of finding ways to help the division or help their manager that weren't in the job description. And the people that were kind of moving up the ranks really quick, you know, you see these 25-year-olds who are already one level down from the CEO. The reason is they do things to make the manager's lives easier or to help the department, may not be written into their job description. I think that's like a key thing that if you want to have a really successful career, you do more than just what you're told to do. You know, you can be very valuable and offer a lot more than just the minimum. But of course, if you do the minimum, that should be enough to keep you in work as long as there is work.
And I think we discussed this in a panel discussion at the BP15 conference too. You actually prefer the personal contact when people apply than you don't have a sort of a form to fill in or anything like that, right?
Yeah. The forms, what happened with us, we had a form, and honestly, the applications were total junk, if I'm honest. We would have one good one literally for 50 or 60 awful. I mean, applications where they don't even tell you what language they do, you know?
Oh, wow.
I mean, just total, you know, and it was just taking too long. Even just reading them would take me 5 minutes. And you think, why am I wasting my time? You know, put your skills where I can see them and I will put you in that file, you know? So, yeah, I think the people that actually take the time to write us a letter or to meet me or to, you know, tweet me or something, nearly always do much, much, they have better, they're usually better translators anyway, and they nearly always do better work when the job actually goes ahead. That's the benefit of being a small company rather than a big, you know, machine. So a small company, we'd like to get to know everyone, and we want to be on their side, and we want them to be on our side, you know, facing the world together.
Good. So you also talked about appearing professional. How can a freelancer appear professional?
That one's very important. I think you've got to understand that, like a recruitment manager, if I'm reading a CV, I'm not going to worry too much about the fonts and things like that. But it's not always me. It could be someone that's on their first day of a new job, and I send them, go through these 50 emails, pick out the five that look the best, and then we'll choose which of them to reply, you know, maybe something like that. So it's got to be stuff that works on a kind of emotional level as well as on an intellectual level. So the intellectual level means that the qualifications mean something to me. I know what those actually are. Like if you say, you know, oh, I'm an engineering translator because I've got a background in engineering, that connects to me immediately and I understand it. You know, but as well as as well as that kind of stuff, there's also things like the font and how tidy the CV looks and what kind of headers and footers your email's got. Does your email account have a photo in the corner? If I have a quick look at your Twitter page, what kind of images will I find? What kind of stuff do I see in there? You know, does it look like you're someone who really cares about doing good work? And that thing, it's hard to sort of put a number on it or say this is good or this is bad, but it gives you a sort of emotional feeling that you add on to the kind of the concrete stuff like the qualifications and the years of experience. And together that makes the overall professionalism experience, you know?
Do you check the social media profiles of people you hire?
Not always. Occasionally I will. It really depends how much time I've got. If they've got a Twitter link right there, I will sometimes click it and have a quick scan. If I'm kind of 50-50 whether we should accept someone's application, I might just have a look at their Twitter or their Facebook, you know? I mean, there was one guy who had He was doing what language? I think it might have been Serbian, or it was an East European language. And I was sort of 50-50 whether I thought this guy would be a good fit. So I clicked on his social media, and it came up with a lot of, let's say, not safe for work images.
Okay.
So immediately I just deleted it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that just seems to me to be completely crazy.
So have a professional looking CV and email, and be professional in your correspondence.
Yeah.
Plus make sure that your online profiles are
yeah, they don't have to be perfect, but reasonably clear, reasonably good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No one expects you to market like McDonald's or KFC or you know, Nike. No one expects that, but we need to see that you've taken the time to spell check everything and read it carefully, and that you look like someone who cares what your work is like, you know? And that impression can come from so many different things. I mean, I found for myself years ago, I hired a logo designer to design a little logo for my CV, CV. And I reckon I got about an extra 20% of the jobs I applied for. That's a very rough rule of thumb, just from having the logo, you know? Just creates this impression in the back of your mind, oh, this guy cares about his work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You were talking about that you don't want to pressure the rates too much for translators. How can we set good rates and make sure that we get paid?
This is the million-dollar question.
Yes, it is.
I think, honestly, there are jobs out there that a freelancer can do better than an agency. And you'll meet freelancers who specialize in doing those kinds of jobs, like very, very, very specialized for a company that doesn't export or import regularly, but, I don't know, a research institute that does, I don't know, fiber optics, and they need to get Japanese patents done once a month or something like that. I'm not sure an agency could help. I mean, maybe we could, maybe we couldn't. I think a freelancer there could make a great value for that kind of situation. As an agency, we would mainly look for things like companies that are looking to start exporting, and they've got a whole thing, websites and brochures and all this other stuff. And part of the issue is that people can only pay what they can pay. And if a company says to me, this is my budget for translation, if it's fixed, it's fixed. You know, our rule of thumb is if we can't even get close to making a profit on it, we won't accept the work. But there's a lot of agencies that do, you know. This is the trouble. I'm constantly competing with agencies that I don't know how they do it, but they work at incredibly low rates. But bearing that in mind, there does seem to be something resembling a kind of median market rate for each language. You can go onto Prose has the survey. I think the ITI, am I right? They do a biannual languages rates survey. I think you can buy it on the website for about £50 or something.
Yes.
Something like that. I think the BDU, the German guys, do one. I might be wrong.
They do.
But that does seem, in my experience, that does kind of fit right into our pricing. So I think there's a safe median, and you need to be not too far away from it. You know, you don't have to be cheap, and we don't mind if you're a bit over as long as your work's good, but we can't use people who are way out of the this kind of median range. So I would say, to set your rates, the best thing is make sure you know what the going rates are for someone with your skills. Know what they are, and then think about your own costs and how much you need to make a living and all that, and then sort of set them, but roughly, you know, try and be realistic about what they actually are and what other people are charging. You know, if you're a brand new graduate, you just graduated last week, and you think you're going to get the same rate as someone who's been doing it 30 years and is a fellow of the ITI, there may be agencies that will do that, and maybe we would do that. But if we've got the choice, we'll go for the guy with 30 years experience, you know?
What if I would contact you and I would quote a really low rate? What would you be your reaction?
Honestly, that puts me off. Low rates are as bad as high rates. You know, they're bad, I think. It just says, you know, do you respect, what do you do with the time? You know, if you can make a I don't know, it's like if you go to a shop, there's something about paying a bit more because you know they made the product carefully. You know, and we're paying for a certain level of service. We expect that level of service, but we don't expect you to, I mean, if some of the rates I've seen people quote, I can't imagine that they can make a living on it, you know?
Okay.
I don't know how on earth they can make anything like a living. And I, you know, I'm not saying you should be millionaires, but I think a freelance translator working fairly regularly should be able to pay a mortgage, should be able to have one holiday, maybe two a year, should be able to, you know, go out at the weekend, you know, like a kind of good, solid middle class salary. That's my, that was what I wanted when I was freelancing. Middle class, you know, you're not going to be a high flying city trader salary, but good, solid middle class salary. I think that's fair. And I think we can work with that with our clients as well.
I think I mentioned this in, I've given webinars on pricing strategies, and this is what I've also said there. If you quote too low, it will also give an unprofessional impression.
Yeah, it is. It's just as bad as quoting ridiculous. Overly high or overly low are as bad as each other. But then again, there are agencies that are just going to want the cheapest. You know, if you want to work for them, good luck. It's not something I want to do. And by the way, you'll never be the cheapest. There's always someone cheaper than you, you know, whether it's someone in India or Bangladesh or, you know, working in a much cheaper country, you're never going to be the cheapest. So I would suggest you should be the best at what you do, and then you can charge a fair rate for it.
Okay. I don't think many agencies discuss this, especially not with freelance translators, but I saw this on your presentation description too. Markup, agency markups. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So there's two aspects to a markup. The first thing is there's the cost of actually getting a job done, which we call a cost of sale on an accounting entry. So if a job comes in and we have to pay you to do it, that actual cost that we pay to you is the cost of sale. Then we've got the cost of actually...
The translation rates, right?
Yeah, so that's basically... But it could also be little, like a portion towards the phone bill maybe for getting the phones, you know, getting the job set up, something towards the accountancy system to register the job, you know, small, but it's quite small. But then there's the other cost, which is the cost that it takes to keep the company running, whether we've got a job or not. And those things are potentially your rent or your lighting and... you know, your electronics and your computers and marketing, you know. And this is where the markup to me gets very confusing. Does markup, normally when we talk about a markup, we're talking about marking up the costs that we pay to the translator. But I could mark up a job that a translator does by 10% and we would still make a loss because we have to spend money to actually get the clients through the door. So in terms of markup, based on the numbers that you hear bandied about vary from the lowest I've heard is 10, which I don't know how you could run it. I mean, just paying a project manager for 5 minutes to read an email, so project manager's getting £10 an hour and they have to read five emails to deliver the job. That's an hour's work. That £10 has to come from somewhere, you know, and then you've got to pay for the project manager when they're sick for 2 weeks. When they've got 5 weeks of holiday a year, maybe towards their pension as well. So, but yeah, the rate seems to be, goes down to 10, which I think is too low, and it goes up to 50, which I think is probably too high. And it's a matter of what your business model is, how much you're spending on growing versus getting clients versus operations.
So what's an average profitable markup for agencies?
It depends on how much they're doing on selling. So like for us, because we're small, we're spending a lot of money on putting things in place that we know our clients will need. So we make a lot. I mean, I work for free, you know, we make a loss every year and all the money we make. So what does profitable mean? You know, nothing is profitable. Once we've been doing that for 10 years and we've got a good base of clients who we trust and who trust us, then potentially we wouldn't have to spend a penny. We can just go out to the translators and mark up their job, and that's profit. So there's a very, very different, very, very different kind of feeling. So I don't know. I mean, if you go to industry conferences, you hear the number 30% as a kind of a rough figure quoted. But it really does depend on where the agency is and where they're going. There's a lot of agencies which I say are fat and happy, which means they've spent all the money they need to spend. They're where they want to be. That means all the money that they make from the markup is profit and goes into the bank, you know, into their they can obviously have a much lower markup than a company that's just got to spend, you know, £100,000 to get a new software system put in. You know, so it's I still find the world of rates to be completely crazy. But as a freelancer, I think 30 to 50 is a bit high. Lower than 30 seems a bit low. You know, so 30 is the number that you'll hear most often.
Okay. All right. So this is a question I ask everyone I interview. What marketing strategy is working well for you right now when you market your agency to companies?
So the thing that works for us is in the UK, people tend not to be, they're not language, we're not particularly conscious of languages. The concern that clients have is, I can't read this thing that you've given me. How do I know this says what I want it to say? And it's trust. So the thing that we do is we try and build that trust and say, look, we're serious, we're here, we want to help you. And when a company gets three quotes, and the first quote is £100, another quote is £1,000, and another quote is £500, and we all say, this is the cost of doing a good job, this will be a good translation you can use. How is the client supposed to take that information on board? You know, and this is a huge problem that we've got. And the way we do it is that we like to meet with people face to face. I like to get in a room with someone and really understand their business. And if I can't do something to help their business, I'll just won't do it. I don't go in looking to sell a translation to them. I go in looking to help them export. And I don't, I'm not doing any other value added export services. But I will sit down and I will say, you know, how much are you looking to spend and what results are you expecting? And then look at what they need in terms of their contracts, their freelancers, hire chains and all the other stuff. And basically for me, it's getting in a room with someone and really understanding what they're doing and giving as much advice, honest, not trying to sell anything, just giving them honest advice based on my experience. And so far that has worked much better than web marketing has, or social media. Both of those were a waste of time.
So you go to a lot of networking events and conferences.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I think that your agency is going to succeed, and I would like to work for your agency.
Well, you would be more than welcome.
Okay.
All right.
So I would also like to thank all the listeners for taking time out of your days to listen to these good advice. Don't forget to check out the show notes and links at marketingtipsfortranslators.com. I will also put a link to constructive translations there. And you can also support the podcast there with a donation if you want, and if you like these podcasts. And you can also check out other free resources. So thank you, David, and thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Hi there, this is Tess. Before we get into this week's episode, a short message about a new course. Is this you? You finally, or unfortunately, have some time to work on your business and website, but you don't know where to start. You know that you can make your website, your social media profiles, especially your LinkedIn profile, and your online content better to get it to show up higher in the search results and attract ideal clients to you so that you can hit the ground running once the economy has recovered. If so, I would like to invite you to my new mini course opening in May, complete with a guest teacher who is an expert on LinkedIn marketing. The course is called Inbound Marketing for Freelance Translators and Interpreters: How to Transform Your Website and Online Presence into Client-Generating Machines. There's no better time than now to review your online presence and make sure that you are attracting your ideal clients. That's why I wanted to offer you this course right now. I have guided over 200 students through this content in live or online workshops, and now I'm updating it and making it available as an online course that you can go through at your own pace and when it works for you. This course doesn't only cover an optimized website and its content or an optimized LinkedIn profile. It also covers all your online presence and how to use inbound marketing and content marketing to attract your ideal clients. Go to marketingtipsfortranslators.com/inbound-marketing for more information and to sign up. I will also put a link to this in the show notes. Thank you for listening to Marketing Tips for Translators. I hope you found some good tips to apply to your freelance career. If you did, a great way to show this is by leaving a review on your favorite podcast listening app or to share the episode with other colleagues. Do you have a topic, question, or a guest you would like to hear about here? Send me an email to podcast@marketingtipsfortranslators.com.